All the family tablets were left in Changsha. What didn't burn with the house was probably destroyed by fighting. Even if they survived, we have no way to get them. There are no household registration records with our names in Taiwan. We use names from Pei Wen's family, remember? Please forgive me. It was the best decision, the only decision at the time. You don't need to send so much money to me. I am just fine. You must save for Lily's school and for your household. The distance between us is far, but I am happy knowing you and your family are safe and healthy. That is all I want. Ma. Henry curses. How can there be no documentation showing that his mother is his mother? And why does he need papers and forms to prove this? In frustration, he slams his fist on the table, and the vase of lilacs next to him tips over. Water pools across the table. He jumps up and grabs the letter, knocking the vase to the floor in his haste. It shatters, pieces scattering and skidding. He looks down at the drowned lilacs and broken glass. It was Rachel's favourite vase.
Daddy?
Lily stands at the door. The vase fell over, Henry says, his pulse still throbbing. It was an accident.
Are you okay, Daddy?
He doesn't want that scared look in her eyes.
Yes, he says carefully. I'm okay. But I'm angry.
He kneels to pick up the glass.
At me?
No, not you, little girl.
Then who? Nai Nai? Mummy?
He shakes his head.
Just angry.
In the end, Henry writes down that Mei Lin Shui is his aunt. He writes a letter that says she will live with them. He can provide for her. That his family needs her and she needs them. Maybe you could say that she is a close aunt who raised me, practically a mother, Rachel suggests. He adds this and hopes that close aunt will be good enough. He mails the application. Henry's habit of scanning the post for a blue airmail envelope with his American name carefully written out in his mother's penmanship, raised lines of Chinese characters bulging through from the other side, shifts to anticipating an official kind of envelope, something from the government. Spring turns to summer, and Mei Lin writes to say that more people are leaving Taiwan. Pei Wen's daughter, Hui Fang, and her family are headed to Australia to be with her sister, Hui Qing. Pei Wen and Yu Ping have managed to get visas to the US and will join Hui Bao in Pennsylvania. The Sues have emigrated to Canada, where their daughter now lives. Mrs. Su's parting words to Mei Lin were that if she couldn't go to the US, she should try to move somewhere else in Taipei. If the communists come, they will certainly come to these apartments. At the very least, she should destroy any letters and papers that connect her to Renshu. When the official government response finally comes, it is not the full-size manila envelope stuffed with packets and further forms that Henry expected. Instead, Rachel hands him a thin, simple envelope. Filled with foreboding, he pauses. Whatever it says, Rachel says, she is your mother. Nothing will change that. There is the sound of rustling paper as Rachel picks up and smooths out the letter he has crumpled and tossed aside. She reads aloud, mostly to herself. Unfortunately, aunts, uncles, cousins, or in-laws are not considered immediate relatives. Therefore, we cannot grant Mrs. Mei Lin Shui an immigrant visa on the basis of family reunification. She is, of course, welcome to make an application to visit your family on a temporary tourist visa, or put in a general application for the annual quota of Chinese immigrants to the United States of America. He keeps his back to her. Hearing the words aloud has solidified the reality. Henry, Rachel starts, and puts her arm around his shoulder. He stiffens and pulls away. She lets her arm drop, but stays by his side. What now? She asks, staring out the window with him.
I don't know.
Henry stares at the bald patches of dirt in their overlooked garden.
We'll try again,
Rachel says, determination in her voice, There must be a way. We could talk to an immigration lawyer, get a temporary visa and convert it to a permanent one. Maybe there are other types of visas. Someone, somewhere, will have an idea. Over the next weeks, they research other options. Can they demonstrate that Mei Lin has expertise in science, maths, or engineering? No. Does she have the capital and experience to establish a self-sustaining business? No. Is she a political refugee? Not anymore, at least not in the eyes of the US government. Would she be coming as an investor? No. Would she be filling a job for which qualified US workers are not available? At nearly 67 years old, probably not. They are advised that if she falls into none of these preferred categories, they should apply for one of the remaining direct immigration visas. Approximately 200 of these are available each year. However, as there is a backlog, the waiting period for approval may be significant, in some cases stretching into years. We've done everything we could, we really have. Rachel adds the final letter of advice to the pile of paperwork they have accumulated. Henry knows she's right, but knowing this brings no consolation. Not an immediate relative. The words swim and blur as his eyes fill. Mei Lin is his ma. Not an immediate relative. Henry wonders if his English has failed him. Taipei, Taiwan, August 1979. Mei Lin is waiting. At exactly 10 a.m., the phone rings. Renju?
Ma.
His voice sounds like a flag that has lost the breeze. None of his news surprises her, but she couldn't have predicted how a distance she has carried folded up inside for so long now expands. What began as a growing sense of separation in Keelung Harbour almost 20 years ago has swelled to become an ocean she cannot cross.
What about a tourist visa? You could come and stay for a few months, see how you like it.
A welcome predicated on leaving? Flying so far just to come back? Maybe, Mei Lin says. Renshu continues, trying to fill a space that has been drained of hope. He is saying something about the possibility of visa rules and quotas changing. Does she want to step into another country? Begin again in another language? New food, new people? Start over like a child at nearly 70? What Mei Lin knows is life in Taipei. She can find somewhere else in the city to live. Who would bother an old woman with no ties to anyone? She has her savings. Over the years, Renshu has sent money for anything she could want. For years now, she has spent her mornings in the park, meeting the same friends for Tai Chi and gossip. Even though the city has grown beyond recognition, she can still find all that she wants in the market. Her life here is hers, and it is enough.
Renshu,
Mei Lin interrupts. Do you remember our hand scroll? He stops speaking. His half-formed dream vanishes.
Of course. We love that scroll.
A warm timbre has replaced the thin strain of worry in his voice. Do you remember the end? In the quiet, Mei Lin hopes he is imagining the final scene, where the scholar traveller rests in the shade of cherry blossoms, writing and reciting poetry, while small birds flit and chirp among the branches above. Renshu, I am fine here. Your life is there now, with Rachel, with Lily. Never mind about the papers, the visas. I'll tell you what I want instead. She pauses.
What?
His voice is both cautious and curious. An orchard. Plant an orchard, Renshu. Promise? A long pause.
Okay, Ma. I promise.
That night, Henry dreams in Chinese. He is high in the mountains. He has travelled by foot and is weary, oh so weary. While climbing, he approached with hope, but now that he has arrived, loss echoes everywhere. The terraces are overgrown with weeds. Piles of stones slump where once there were buildings. No one has been here for a long time. Among the ruins grows an orchard. Where did the seeds come from? A passerby dropping fruit? A gift from the birds? Henry dreams an orchard. He dreams soft clouds of blossoms, boughs full of pinks and whites, reaching their arms to blue skies, promising bounty. The blossom scent will carry an elixir for happiness, a balm to soothe his sadness. He imagines fruit swelling under rain and sun, caressed by warm breezes. At summer's end, he wants to sink his teeth into ripeness, straight off the tree, bursting with sweet, tart juices. He wants to devour a year's growth in a few happy mouthfuls. Cherries, peaches, plums, he will tend them all, transform this land into his own Chinese hand scroll, a refuge, an orchard. When he wakes, he pages through seed catalogues. He pauses at the pictures of trees in full leaf, his hand resting on the photos of dark, glossy fruit. His mouth begins to water as he completes the order form, writes a check, addresses the envelope, and licks a stamp. Henry has ordered 2 baby cherry trees. Henry curses as a shovel hits another stone. "Break my back," he says, shaking his head, wiping his face with the edge of his sweat-stained T-shirt.
"What are you doing?"
He looks at her. Messy pigtails, uneven bangs, dirt in the creases of her knees, her brown legs sticking out from under her red sundress. He reaches out to rumple her hair, then digs the shovel in again. Hits stone once more.
"Are you digging a hole all the way to China?"
The ground is pocked with loose gravel. It holds little moisture and less promise. He removes big chunks of tufa, piling them up next to the pit where he will plant his cherry tree.
"Last year, in Miss Stanford's class, we read a story about someone who dug a hole so deep it went to China. She said it was a fable, which means it's not exactly true, but not exactly false either. I wonder which part was true and which part wasn't."
The soil is thin and meager in this land of plenty. Here, where rain is scant and the crown cracks in the summer, where thunderclouds build false hope every afternoon. The moisture is absorbed by the thirsty air before it can reach the parched land. Still, Henry dreams an orchard. Cherry, peach, apricot, plum. Stone fruits with their vibrant colours and flavours of sun. He keeps digging. Maybe past the topsoil, past the volcanic rocks, the soil will become rich and nutrient-filled. When he reaches clay instead, he curses.
"So are you? Are you digging a hole to China?"
She is still there, sitting on the ground, inspecting the rocks he has unearthed. "Maybe, little girl, maybe." He tosses the shovel into the pit and goes inside. The trees arrive by special delivery. Lonely little sticks poking out of small burlap sacks. They look like orphans from a kinder, lusher land, clutching their only belongings. Henry swallows his disappointment and concentrates instead on the tags attached to the branches. He squints at the print beneath the photos.
"Are those supposed to be cherry trees?"
Lily asks. "Yes." He can't think of anything to add.
"They look like sticks in the mud."
She plays with the frayed edges of the sacks.
"Have you ever heard of that?"
He shakes his head.
"A stick in the mud is someone who doesn't want to have fun and doesn't want anyone else to have fun either."
Henry doesn't say anything. After Lily goes inside, he carefully lowers one of the trees into the hole. The hole is almost deeper than the tree is tall. He needs some enriched soil and compost. The soil here isn't good enough to support fruit trees. Rachel joins him in the garden. He glowers. Who buys dirt? "At least add some peat and wood chips. That would keep the moisture in." He ignores her. "Those trees will need nutrients, fertilizer, food. They won't grow otherwise." Henry doesn't trust soil from a plastic bag. If he digs deep enough, he's certain he will find good earth. He shovels dirt and rubble into the hole, trying to support the tree, patting down the light soil and watering it with the garden hose. The other tree he carries to the front yard, to a hole he has dug near the end of the drive. There are two towering cottonwoods already, but he wants a cherry tree there too. The hole is only deep enough to hold the root ball of the sapling, and there's not much space between it and the cement drive, but he plants it anyway.
That's the worst possible place for a cherry tree, Rachel criticizes, following him. There is no light and it's right near the edge of the driveway.
He brushes past her with the hose. The next day, she backs the car into the tree twice, first rushing out of the drive on the way to the grocery store, and again later on her way to pick up Lily from a friend's.
Why can't you be more careful? He complains. Why can't you plant a tree in a sensible place?
The cherry tree at the end of the drive never takes root. After being run over and replanted too many times, its few buds wither and fail to open. By September, it is a brittle and dry stick in the mud. It doesn't last the winter. Chapter 23. Los Alamos, New Mexico, March 1980. This year, Lily's in fourth grade, and she has the best teacher. In Miss Gibson's classroom, there are interesting maps on the wall showing other continents, like Asia and Africa and South America, with photos of the people who live there. There are posters of mountains, deserts, jungles, rivers. Each Monday, on a bulletin board titled What I Noticed Last Week, Miss Gibson writes things like Emily shared her seat with Joanne, or Daniel included Freddie in the kickball game. Her handwriting is perfect. All the letters find their places in the right order and right size on the name tags on each desk. No one's name is too long or too short for the space. Each name seems to glow when she writes it out. Last year, when Denny Henderson teased Lily, saying she had slanty eyes, and chased her at recess, yelling, "Egg Foo Young," an ancient Chinese secret, the teacher told him to knock it off, and that it wasn't Lily's fault she was different. But even though the teacher made Danny stop, Lily felt worse than ever. Miss Gibson isn't like that. She makes it so the kids don't tease in the first place. Danny hasn't said one mean word or made any horrible faces so far this year, to anyone. It is Friday afternoon, and Miss Gibson welcomes everyone back to the classroom after lunch for a special activity. On the blackboard, she has drawn a tree trunk and a few branches in white chalk. In the trunk of the tree, she writes Ellie Gibson. Higher up, the trunk divides into two. She picks up a green piece of construction paper that has been cut in the shape of a leaf. Miss Gibson writes Anna, Mum, then sticks it on the right branch. She picks up another leaf, writes Charles, Dad, and sticks it on the left branch. Can anyone guess how this works? Those are the names of your family? She nods. We are going to make our family trees. Each person in your family has a leaf on the tree. One side holds the leaves from your mother's family, and the other holds the leaves from your father's family. All families look different, just like all trees look different, but they all have leaves. Miss Gibson goes over to the supplies table and holds up a sheet from a stack of brown paper. You can draw your trunk and branches on this, and, gesturing to smaller stacks of paper in light and dark greens, you can cut your leaves from these. Shall we get started? All is eager. Lily takes some sheets of paper. She starts by drawing the trunk and branches. She carefully cuts out several leaves, then starts to write. She starts with her mum, then continues with that side of the family, sticking on leaves for her grandparents, uncle, aunt, cousins. Lily looks at the other side of her tree. She picks up a leaf and writes, Henry Dow. Then she thinks of those blue airmail envelopes from her Nainai in Taiwan. What is Nainai's name? She stops. She doesn't know. All around, Lily sees other trees filling with leaves, big and small. Kids are asking Miss Gibson where to put uncles, cousins, aunts, great-grandparents, second cousins. But Lily is stuck, her cheeks warm with shame. She doesn't know the names. Her dad never mentioned anyone else. Are there others?
This is stupid,
someone says from the back. Lily glances over. It's Danny. Miss Gibson goes and speaks to him in a hushed voice.
No, it's boring,
he says, and crumples his brown paper into a ball. Only Lily notices. Most of the other kids have finished, and the room is getting louder. Small leaves start sailing through the air. Miss Gibson says something to Danny, then walks to the front of the room.
Clean up time. 5 minutes until the bell.
She circulates again, praising and asking questions, pointing out scraps of paper to tidy, transmitting warning looks to boys who are teetering on hilarity. Lily stares at her paper. How's your tree coming along, Lily? Covering her dad's side with her arm, Lily launches into an explanation of her mother's side. If she talks enough, there won't be time for Miss Gibson to ask about the empty half. She tells Miss Gibson about Grandma Deborah, who thinks she should wear more dresses, and her Grandpa Simon, who calls her Gook, and she's about to move on to Uncle Robert when Miss Gibson stops her.
He calls you Gook?
Miss Gibson sounds horrified.
It's a nickname.
He's always called me that. Is it bad?
Tell me about the other side of your tree, Miss Gibson says.
Keeping her eyes down, Lily slowly reveals the bare branches with only two leaves.
I don't know anyone else, she mutters.
It's okay, Lily. It's been a long afternoon. When Lily looks up, she notices that Miss Gibson's smile is strained and her eyes are a bit glassy. Lily nods and blinks back tears. She stuffs her paper into her bag and heads out to the buses. When she gets home, Lily takes the crumpled paper and smooths it out on the kitchen table. She studies the tree. She knows that her dad was born in China, then moved to Taiwan, then came to the US. She knows his mom is in Taiwan. That's all. She's never met her. Her dad doesn't speak Chinese to her mum, or to anyone really. Sometimes, Lily feels like there's something she's supposed to know that she doesn't, or something she's supposed to be that she isn't. When she asks her dad about his past, he says he doesn't remember. Her mum has told her not to ask, that it upsets him because it was hard to grow up during the war. They must, her mum emphasises, focus on the family they are now. She hears the front door open. Her mum is home. Should she put the paper away? Lily's mum is humming to herself as she puts away her coat, opening and closing the closet. Now she's coming down the hallway. Lily sits motionless.
Oh, Lily, you gave me a scare. I thought you'd be with your friends at the park. It's gorgeous out, now that spring is finally here.
Tears start rolling down Lily's cheeks.
What is it? What's wrong?
Rachel comes over to hug her daughter. Lily buries her face in Rachel's shoulder, sobbing out the story of the afternoon, her frustration.
Oh, honey.
Rachel holds Lily, murmuring soft reassurances, but she offers no answers to Lily's questions about Henry. Leaning on one elbow, her chin in her hand, Rachel considers the tree.
You've done a brilliant job with my family.
I love how you made each person's leaf a different shape.
Mum, what's a gook?
What?
Did someone at school call you that?
Rachel immediately sounds angry.
No, but Grandpa Simon does. Is it bad?
Grandpa. Rachel taps her fist to her mouth, working out what to say. Grandpa doesn't mean anything bad when he says that, but he shouldn't. It's not a nice word to call anyone. People sometimes use it to make fun of people who are Asian or who look Asian. Lily bursts into fresh tears.
Oh, Lily.
Rachel drops her back and continues looking at the paper. After some time, she says, I like how you've arranged the little leaves for Uncle Robert and Aunt Wendy's kids. And putting the twins on the same stem is so clever. Her fingers rest on the names of Lily's youngest cousins. But Lily indicates her father's side of the tree. Rachel nods. I know, sweetie. Let me talk to your dad. That night, after Lily is asleep, Rachel comes into the living room. She holds out Lily's tree like a banner for Henry to read. He puts his book aside. Lily's schoolwork? Very nice, he says, not sure what he's supposed to see. No, it's not. Her finger taps the side with only two leaves. Henry leans closer to see his name written on one and Nainai written on the other. Rachel puts the paper down and crosses her arms. When I came home, she was really upset because she couldn't add any other leaves and doesn't even know her own grandmother's name. Henry, she wants to know more. It's her family too. Henry sits back in his chair. Some families are small. He shrugs. That's not the point. The point is that she doesn't know about your background, and she wants to. I understand you don't want to talk about the past, but Lily should know her own grandmother. I'd like to meet her too. Besides, having a small family is all the more reason to hold everyone close. Don't you want your mother to meet her grandchild? Don't you want to bring everyone together, even if only for a visit? Taipei, Taiwan, April 1980. Mei Lin sits in the courtyard of Lin Na's house and reads over Ren Chu's latest letter. He wants her to spend the summer with them in New Mexico. Rachel needs to be away for a few weeks for a librarian training course. Lily wants to meet her Nainai. Would Mei Lin come and help out while Rachel is gone? She is thinking about the opportunity when Lin Na comes and joins her in the shade. Mei Lin tells her friend about Ren Chu's news. Wow, are you going to go? I'm not sure yet. Really? Why not? How long has it been since you've seen him? Don't you want to meet your grandchild and daughter-in-law? Of course I do, but it's such a long trip. Mei Lin hesitates, not sure what this feeling is that holds her back. She thinks of the logistics, passport, planning, plane travel, going to another country where, once again, she doesn't speak the language. But it's not just the hassle. It's all those years of living so far apart. What if they no longer recognize each other? What if the reunion makes them feel even more distant? If it were me, I'd be jumping on a plane to go see them. Go. Then you'll know what it's like where they live. You can imagine their house, their foods, the trees and streets. If I had family in America, I'd go and see the Golden Gate Bridge and the Statue of Liberty. Why not? Maybe you're right. Whatever her worries, Mei Lin admits, the alternative of not seeing Ren Chu and his family seems far worse. It's just for the summer. He says if I like it, we can try to find another way for me to stay. Would you want to? I don't know. Mei Lin looks around. In the cool and shady courtyard, Lin Na's husband has set up a small pond with goldfish and a fountain. I like it here. Once her plans for emigrating to the US fell through, and the Su's and Peiwen's family had left Taiwan, Mei Lin sought out her old friend at the Yongle fabric market. The Ben Zhengren woman had always been friendly, but Mei Lin hadn't seen her as much since moving to the Da'an apartment. Mei Lin hoped to sell Lin Na some of the silks and cottons Mrs. Su left behind. Lin Na was happy to buy the fabrics and asked how Mei Lin had been. When Mei Lin explained that she was, once again, looking for somewhere to live, Lin Na had offered the space in her home until Mei Lin found something. Lin Na's family quickly grew so fond of Mei Lin they insisted she stay. After 6 months living here in Da Dao Cheng, she is practically one of the family. Despite widespread fears, the PRC didn't immediately invade Taiwan. And although the American flag no longer proudly flies downtown, a new office has been established, the American Institute in Taiwan, down a drab back alley. It seems that the US, despite courting Beijing with one hand, hovers protectively over Taiwan with the other. But in Taiwan, it's been industry, not military, that has been striding forward. Businesses have sprung up all over the island, making computer peripherals, electronics, cameras. Trade and investment between the US and the ROC booms. Over the past decades, the island's economy and infrastructure have grown. Many who left Taiwan to study in the US now return, bringing their business connections and technical expertise. Many of those who stayed in the US have fostered collaborations back home in Taiwan. The little island is becoming a mighty tiger, an economic miracle. Taipei is constantly growing. Mei-Lin watches this burgeoning economy and can't help but think that old Dao Hongshe would approve. Money, trade and commerce are mightier than ideology and more devastating than swords. Kerosene is good business. Everyone needs heat. Everyone needs light. Now, it is electronics and computers that everyone needs. The next week, Mei-Lin writes back to Renshu. I will come. Mei-Lin grips the armrests as the plane leaves the ground. She is uneasy seeing the land far beneath her feet. The houses get smaller and smaller. The roads become squiggles. For the first time in years, she thinks of the bombs falling in Chongqing. She remembers always looking up at the planes. Now she looks down. How easy it would have been for those Japanese pilots, not having to look anyone in the eye, not even having to see the people below. As easy as dropping a handful of pebbles on dirt. The flight seems endless, and Mei-Lin cannot find any comfort in her seat. The recirculated air has a cold, sterile taste. Every minute takes her closer to Renshu. But at the same time, every minute takes her further away from all that she has come to know. Los Alamos, New Mexico, June 1980. Of course, he recognizes her the minute she steps through the airport gate. But she's different. Smaller. Grayer. She's 68, and the 20 years since he waved goodbye from Keelung Harbour have softened her shoulders, her cheeks, the skin around her eyes. Her hair, as ever, is pulled into a simple bun at the nape of her neck. She wears a brown knitted vest over a light blue silk tunic. Her trousers are simple. He is sure she has made all her clothes. Her eyes, though, still have that gentle kindness and deep intelligence. She reaches up to welcome Rachel. Their embrace is awkward but affectionate. When she sees Lily, her smile grows even wider. Then it's a barrage of sensations. The brush of his ma's soft cheek, the rough wool of her vest against his palm, the smell of camphor in her embrace. He feels the cool silk of her sleeves, the grasp of her fingers on his back, her voice in his ear, right there, not through a hard plastic telephone handset, but right there, where he can feel the vibrations of her saying his name. For nearly two decades, he has been far away from these textures, scents, and sounds of home. His eyes swim with the immensity and immediacy of it all. Welcome, Ma, he murmurs. Renshu. She nods into his chest. Nai Nai is staying in Lily's room. During her visit, Lily will sleep on a mattress in her father's study. He cleared a shelf for her, and she has filled it with a stack of library books, some stuffed animals, a Hello Kitty notebook, coloured pencils and stickers. Nai Nai brings gifts from Taiwan, glittery barrettes with butterflies and pearly beads, a tin full of mooncakes, a small satin purse with a single snap containing a jade elephant and a gold bell, a plastic box filled with Chinese vocabulary flashcards, the miniature toothpaste tube and eye mask from the flight. Lily loves it all. Nai Nai has brought a jade pendant in the shape of a pair of plums for her mum. It has a red string running through its small gold loop. Rachel admires it, then says, "Oh," and goes to their bedroom. When she comes back, The pendant hangs from a gold chain Henry gave her for their 10th wedding anniversary. Henry gives her a kiss on the cheek. Nainai nods in approval. Then, for her dad, Nainai unpacks a porcelain teapot with bamboo handles and two blue and white porcelain teacups. Each has a domed lid and sits on a small saucer. The cups have a pattern like evenly spaced grains of rice. They have no handles. Her dad's face lights up as he lifts and admires each one. Finally, Nainai hands him a cylindrical red tin of tea. He takes the lid off and inhales happily. "Are you hungry? Tired? Would you like a rest?" Rachel asks. Renshu translates and Meilin nods. "A little hungry, and yes, a rest would be good." After eating a bit of rice, Meilin goes to her room to lie down. She falls asleep to the sounds of Rachel getting Lily ready for bed and Renshu washing up in the kitchen. She wakes early, disorientated by the dim light in the room. She pulls back the curtains to see pine trees and, in the distance, mountains. The air feels dry and she's a bit lightheaded. Hearing movement downstairs, she puts on her slippers and a dressing gown and heads down for something to drink. Renshu is awake. When she comes into the kitchen, he fills the kettle and sets it on the stove. While it heats, he taps a few tea leaves into the cups. The kettle whistles. He pours the water right up to the rims, letting it spill over the edges, then puts the lids on. She slides into a seat at the table. "I like Rachel," she says, as he sits down across from her. He smiles and peeks under the lid to see if his tea is ready. "And Lily reminds me of Liling. Not just her face, but her whole manner." She lifts the saucer and sips her tea. Finally, the taste soothes her parched throat. Hot, pungent, and comforting. They are quiet for a few moments. "You know, she's about the same age Liling was when we lost her," Meiling reflects.
"Wow, you're right. I hadn't thought of that."
He leans forward on one elbow, holding his chin in his palm, shaking his head. "I wonder what kind of woman she'd have grown into," Meilin muses. "Lively, I'm sure. Stunning, too. You could always see Wenling's beauty just ready to burst through in Liling."
"When I was first at Northwestern," Renshu says, "I went to Chinatown in Chicago a few times with Chen. Sometimes, maybe in a restaurant or on a crowded street, I'd think I could see Liling. I knew it was impossible, but still, I'd be scanning faces for the rest of the afternoon, looking for her."
"Imagine what Wenling would think of her handsome nephew doing so well in America," Meilin exclaims. "She'd either be very jealous or very proud, I expect."
"Probably both," Renshu laughs.
Meilin reaches out and squeezes his hand. "I miss them all," she says.
"Me too."
Again, they are quiet for several minutes.
"Ma?"
"Hmm?"
"The story of Peach Blossom Spring."
"You remember it? One of my favourites."
"Of course I remember. But, Ma, when you told it to me so long ago, you didn't tell the whole story. Why?"
"I didn't."
"You left out how, after the fisherman returns home, he can never find Peach Blossom Spring again. No one else can either."
"Oh," she says, sounding surprised. "I wonder why I did that."
"I don't know."
She furrows her brow, as if to summon the Meilin and Renshu of so long ago, their fears, their hopes. She shakes her head and repeats, "I don't know." She traces the edge of her tea saucer with her index finger. After a few moments, she says, "I guess the thing about Peach Blossom Spring is that if you are fortunate enough to find it, you are also unfortunate, because then you have to decide what to do. Do you stay and forgo all else? Or do you return home with the understanding that you'll never find it again? Is it a blessing? Is it a curse?" Renshu doesn't answer. Soon they hear footsteps running overhead and down the stairs. Nai-Nai, good morning! Lily shouts, bursting into the room, giving her a big hug. What shall we do today? Once she's recovered from jet lag and become more accustomed to the dry air, Mei-Lin's visit passes pleasantly. They visit a few attractions in Los Alamos. At the Science Museum, they see models of Little Boy and Fat Man, the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Each is only about 10 feet long. At 5 feet in height, Fat Man is barely taller than Mei-Lin. Little Boy is even smaller. Mei-Lin puts her hand on the cold metal casing, painted white. Far away in China, while she and Renshu had lived and mourned and fled and lost and feared, here, in this very place, in this town with too much light and not enough air, scientists had worked to create destruction. She wouldn't have wanted the war to last any longer. And yet, there must be better ways of finding peace. They also visit the Bandelier National Monument and show her the caves and ancient dwellings of the Pueblo people. Later, they visit the plaza in Santa Fe. Mei-Lin loves looking at the Native American jewelry for sale in front of the Palace of the Governors. She likes the silver-beaded necklaces with charms of bears, birds, and turtles carved from turquoise, coral, and lapis. She buys gifts to take back to Lin Na. Rachel and Lily take her to a fabric shop in Santa Fe, and she is amazed at the selection. They stock up so she can sew pajamas and knit afghans for the winter. About a week after Mei-Lin's arrival, Rachel leaves for her course. She'll also spend a week in St. Louis visiting her parents. Mei-Lin respects Rachel's ambition, and she's proud that Henry wants to support her career. She also likes that she is playing a small part in helping Rachel to see her parents. After dropping Rachel off at the airport, Henry, Lily, and Mei-Lin make a trip to the Chinese grocery store in Albuquerque. Although it's nowhere near as nice as the markets in Taipei, they fill a trolley with tins of vegetables, packets of dried mushrooms and noodles, spices, tofu, bottles of dark soy sauce, sesame oil and oyster sauce, chili flakes, and a 50-pound bag of rice. Nai-Nai takes up residence in the kitchen. She is always at the table, chopping, preparing, cleaning, knitting, or drinking tea. The stove is never quiet, never clear. Lily loves that there is always something bubbling, waiting to be eaten or not quite ready yet. Chop, chop, chop. Nai-Nai's big cleaver minces a pile of mushrooms and pork. Scrape, scrape. It brings together the fillings. Chop, chop, chop again, until all the pieces are mixed into a pale pink paste with creamy white bits of garlic, small green flecks of scallion and ginger fibres. She adds some salt, massages it in with her fingers, scrapes the mixture into a pile. Chop, chop, chop. Jiaozi, says Nai-Nai. Jiaozi? Repeats Lily. Nai-Nai nods and rolls out a ball of dough into a thin sheet. Then she picks up a water glass with the rim floured and presses out a perfect circle. She lifts it carefully from the board and puts it to the side. Lily, she says, handing her the glass. Lily likes it when Nai-Nai says her name. It sounds so pretty in her voice. Nai-Nai rolls more dough, and Lily presses out more circles. Nai-Nai dusts them with fine flour so that they don't stick to one another. When all the circles are ready, Nai-Nai places a spoonful of filling on one. She dips her index finger into a shallow bowl of water, then traces the edge. She folds the wrapper over the meat mixture, lining up the ends, then pinches them into a serrated seam. She puts the jiaozi in an empty steamer basket lined with cabbage leaves. You try, she says in English, handing Lily a circle. Lily's seams aren't even, and her wrapper keeps tearing. Some of her dumplings have too much filling, while others have too little. Never mind, Nai-Nai seems to say, and she pinches them closed all the same, adding them to the bamboo basket. Henry can hear Lily and Mei-Lin in the kitchen. Lily speaks to Mei-Lin in English, and Mei-Lin responds in Chinese. Despite the different languages, they seem to have a lot to say to each other.
Come eat,
Mei-Lin calls from the kitchen.
Daddy, come on,
Lily calls. In the kitchen, there are steaming bowls of rice with chopsticks and a small fork for Lily. The table is filled with dishes he hasn't had for years. Braised lotus root, stir-fried snow pea leaves, sea cucumber, a whole fish, pork with water chestnuts and mushrooms, beef noodle soup, and a mountain of dumplings. They eat. While Henry gets Lily ready for bed, Mei-Lin starts scrubbing the dishes with warm, frothy suds. Despite the long journey, she's glad to be here, to see Renchu's American life. Coming back into the kitchen, he grabs a towel to help.
It's good to have you here, Ma.
She hands him a dripping plate.
I'm sorry that we haven't found a way for you to stay.
She gives him a big pot to wipe dry. I've been able to meet Lily, and I see how much Rachel loves you. You're very lucky. We're all lucky. She starts rinsing off the chopsticks. Almost done, she says. As he puts the dishes back in their cabinets, he remarks,
It could have been different if Uncle hadn't left your name off my papers.
She fills the kettle and puts it on to boil, turning her back to Renchu. It could have been different. There are so many ways in which it could have been different, so many junctions. In the end, there's nothing to be gained by this kind of thinking.
Long Wei did what he thought was necessary, she says. He should have been honest.
Renchu, nothing was straightforward then. We all had to make difficult choices, you know that.
No, Henry argues. He stole something that wasn't his to take. He broke our bond.
Lower your voice. You'll wake Lily. Her hands are shaking slightly as she gets the cups ready. When she pours hot water into the first, the excess flows over the top, filling the saucer and splashing onto the counter.
It's only paperwork, Renchu. You have your citizenship, your family, your life in America. Leave it alone.
We asked him to help, and he did. If he made a mistake, then forgive him.
Why are you defending him?
Mei-Lin doesn't answer.
I cannot forgive him for leaving off your name. I'll never understand why he did.
Mei-Lin is silent for a long time. She rubs her cheek and eyes. Understanding has always been how Renchu makes meaning. Explanations offer comfort. But here, there are none. We can forgive without understanding. Sometimes we must. Maybe that's what forgiveness is, accepting someone's actions, even if there are no good explanations. Mei-Lin picks up her teacup and takes it to the sink. It's late, Renchu. I'm going to sleep now. She leaves him sitting at the kitchen table.
Nai-Nai, tell me a story.
Mei-Lin understands what the girl is asking, but doesn't know if she can do what she wants.
Please?
Mei-Lin puts down her knitting and stands up. Lily follows her to the study, where Mei-Lin picks up the box of Chinese flashcards. She will try. After several minutes, she finds horse and old man. She puts the two cards out in front of Lily.
Is this a story about an old man and a horse?
Mei-Lin nods and looks for a card to show loss. She can't find one. Lily looks at her expectantly. Mei-Lin finds the card for good fortune, but not the one for disaster. Lily tries to guess the story.
Does the man ride his horse? Does he go to fight battles? Was he once a soldier and now he's old, spending his days peacefully? Is the horse his best friend?
Mei-Lin feels defeated by Lily's questions. She doesn't have enough language. We ask Daddy, she finally says. Mei-Lin and Lily come into the kitchen where he sits, reading the newspaper. Lily is expectant, excited. His ma's face has that combination of helplessness and imperiousness that means she wants him to do something. Tell her.
she says in Chinese. Tell her the stories from when you were little.
No.
He makes a non-committal snort and looks back down at the newspaper.
Ren Shu.
She puts her hand on the print. It's important. If you don't tell her, how will she learn what matters?
She doesn't need to know.
He pulls the paper out from under her hand.
What do you mean?
Mei Lin argues.
Of course she needs to know.
She glances at Lily, whose smile is changing to an expression of worry.
No, she doesn't,
he snaps, getting up from his chair.
What is the point of telling her all those sad stories? I wish I didn't know them myself.
Mei Lin steps back.
I didn't mean our stories, she says, although she will one day want to know those too, she adds quietly.
She puts her arm around Lily. I mean the ones I told you as a child. The rooster, the pear tree, the old man who lost his horse.
Oh. His face relaxes. And then, vaguely, maybe later.
Rachel returns from her course, excited about a career in library science. When Rachel seems a bit taken aback by all the unfamiliar items filling the refrigerator, Mei Lin wonders if she's overstepped. Never mind. There's only a short time left before her return flight. Mei Lin is glad to have come, but she's ready to go back to Taipei. She misses the fountain and goldfish in Lin Na's courtyard. She misses the fresh vegetables from the market and the warm, thick air. Ren Chu asks if she would like to stay longer. Should he keep trying for a permanent visa? His voice is full of hope, but Mei Lin knows that for her, Taipei is home.
Ren Chu, this is your peach blossom spring, not mine.
His expression sobers, crestfallen. Mei Lin continues,
we have feasted, we have celebrated. Now it is time for me to return home.
Okay, Ma,
he finally says, his voice a hoarse whisper.
Okay.
Somehow, Mei Lin's visit has increased the distance between his past and his present. What he thought would build a bridge has, instead, widened an abyss. Part of him is relieved she wants to return to Taipei, and that part of him will always feel guilty. The day before Mei Lin returns to Taiwan, Mei Lin and Lily pull Lily's red wagon to the plant nursery down the road. They buy big bags of mulch and enriched soil and drag the wagon home. Cutting open the bags releases a rich, earthy smell. They dig in with their bare hands. The dark, damp soil crumbles in their fingers. They use it to fill the hollows around the struggling cherry tree in the backyard, tamping down the earth with a shovel. They spread the mulch around its base and water the tree generously. A few weeks later, the tree begins to stretch and grow. Chapter 24, Los Alamos, New Mexico, September 1980. Rachel and Lily are moving Lily's things back into her bedroom. Lily sets down an armful of books as her mother snaps a fresh fitted sheet onto the mattress.
Why couldn't Nai-Nai stay longer?
Rachel shakes out a top sheet and spreads it over the bed.
I don't think she wants to be all by herself in Taipei,
Lily continues.
Why can't she stay here?
Now, Rachel tucks in the edges of a light blue blanket. Lily watches her mother straighten the bedspread and fluff the pillows in their clean cases.
Mom, did you hear me? Should I ask Daddy?
Oh, no, no, Rachel hastens. Don't bother him. He finds it all too upsetting.
But why?
Rachel sits on the bed and pats the covers, motioning for Lily to join. When your daddy was growing up in China, it was wartime. He and Nai-Nai had to move around a lot. Eventually, they went to Taiwan because it was safer. Lily already knows this, but she stays quiet. Maybe her mum will say something new. Things were better in Taiwan. Your daddy studied hard and got a scholarship to come to America.
What was he like when you met him?
Very handsome. Very shy. Rachel laughs.
How did you meet?
Lily likes the way her mum's face softens as she tells the story. From the moment he asked for that shop on recording, I liked him. There was something so different about the way he looked at the world, as if everything mattered. As I got to know him and learned what he had lived through, I realized that his is an old soul. An old soul with fresh eyes. And he was so handsome. Who wouldn't fall for someone like that? A real love story. Yes, Rachel says softly. It was. But why doesn't he want to talk about it? It's a good story with a happy ending. And I still don't see why Nainai can't stay. Somewhere in all the moving around, some papers got confused. The governments think Nainai is his aunt, not his mother, so she can't stay. Why doesn't he just tell them there was a mistake? Can't it be fixed? Rachel sighs. We tried to fix it, but we couldn't. That's what makes him so sad. Oh, Lily has seen this sadness in her father. The last thing she wants is to make him sadder. Well, I'm glad Nainai came to visit. I am too. Lily begins to hound Rachel for more information about China and Taiwan, but Rachel doesn't know much herself. She goes to the library to ask for recommendations, and the librarian points her towards a flyer. A Chinese language and culture course will be starting soon at the community center. The course seems like a perfect compromise. Rachel mentions it to Henry, saying she understands that he wants to leave his past in the past, but Lily has a desire and a right to learn about her heritage. Initially, Henry is reluctant, but Rachel insists. Lily loves the classes. She cannot believe her good fortune. Most of the other kids are Chinese. A few are half Chinese. She's thrilled to make friends who look like her, even if just a little bit, even if they go to different schools. Teacher Lee, whose children are at university, is gentle and generous. Everyone feels included. Rachel likes the classes too. Sometimes, while Lily's in class, Rachel sits outside and chats with the other mothers. She enjoys the solidarity and friendship, especially with the women from mixed couples. They commiserate about the long drives to the Chinese grocery store down in Albuquerque, where their husbands work their way down one aisle and up the next, examining every single vegetable and box of tea. They compare notes about the mysterious packets and tins of sharp-smelling, shriveled-up, dark foods that fill the cupboards and refrigerator. It feels good to exchange stories of misunderstandings and long-distance calls, and about the sometimes joyous, sometimes anxiety-inducing arrival of light blue aerograms in the mail. Los Alamos, New Mexico, June 1981. Henry stands facing his cherry tree, which has grown as tall as Henry himself. At his feet is a roll of netting from the garden store. In the spring, Henry and Lily had watched with joy as blossoms appeared for the first time. Their excitement grew with the arrival of leaves and tiny green fruits. Every so often, Lily's impatience would get the better of her, and she'd taste one. She'd cringe, wrinkling her nose. "Too sour!" she'd cry, in both disgust and delight. Now the cherries have finally started to expand and ripen. But they weren't the only ones watching and waiting. At some point, the birds had made their move. In one day, they'd descended and stolen the best cherries. Henry's trying to figure out how to protect the remaining fruit.
"Lao shu, mouse, xiong mao, panda, shi zi, lion."
Lily runs up. She must be shouting words from her Chinese class. He didn't hear them arrive home. He can't articulate why, but the classes make him uneasy.
"Lao shu, xiong mao, shi zi, mouse, panda, lion."
She dances around him. These are nothing to build sentences with, Henry thinks. Words like pebbles. Lily doesn't care. To her, each word is a jewel. He throws the netting over the branches. He is trying to be gentle with the tender shoots and leaves, but he needs to pull the netting tight.
"Daddy, I learned the character for tree, mu.
It even looks like a tree.
She traces the character Mu on her palm.
Then, if you put two of them side by side, it becomes a character for a small wood, Ling. And finally, if you squish three trees into your character box, one on top and two below, you get Sen, a forest. If you put person and tree together, you get Rest, Xiu. Rest is a person by a tree.
Her tones are all flat, sounding wrong in her mouth.
I remember another word, Niao. Niao means bird. Nai-Nai taught that to me when she was here.
Go get the hose, he says to her. We need to water the tree. She wanders off.
Lao shu, xiong mao, shi zi, niao.
He inspects the netting.
How do you say cherry?
She asks when she returns, lugging the long green garden hose behind her.
Ying tao,
he says, carefully enunciating the tones.
Ying tao,
she repeats, perfectly echoing his words. He holds the hose and watches the water's arc splatter at the base of the tree.
Do you know what else?
She says.
The character for the sun, R, looks like a box with a line, sort of like a sun. And moon, Yue, looks like sun, but with longer lines near the bottom.
She holds out her palm and traces the characters for sun, R, and moon, Yue.
Putting sun and moon together gives you Ming,
bright. Go turn off the water. The tap off, the tree watered, Henry winds up the hose. Lily follows him up the stairs and into the house.
I love this language, Daddy.
Los Alamos, New Mexico, January 1982.
Guess what? Guess what we did?
Lily bursts into the room, and before Henry can reply, she continues,
we made banners for Chinese New Year.
She unrolls a red scroll of paper where she has painted in black brushstrokes in English, 1982, Year of the Dog. The characters Gong Xi Fa Chai have been printed, cut out and glued on, alongside stickers of lanterns and firecrackers. Hand-drawn dogs decorate the edges, accompanied by liberal doses of glitter and gold ribbons.
The characters say Gong Xi Fa Chai.
She taps each with her index finger.
It means wishing you joy and prosperity.
Very nice, little girl, he says. The purple mimeograph characters, glued at slightly odd angles, look out of place in his American kitchen.
Can we go?
Go where? Lily has been talking and he missed her question.
The party. There's a Chinese New Year's party and everyone and their families are invited. I want to go. Please? Please?
Henry looks over at Rachel, who hands him a photocopy of a hand-drawn invitation. Along either side is a sketch of a vertical banner with a New Year's couplet written in Chinese calligraphy. Each banner has been coloured in with a red crayon. A red diamond-shaped sticker with a gold character for blessings sits proudly at the top. Below, in English, you and your family are invited to join us for a celebration of language, culture and food to welcome in the Year of the Dog. Bring a potluck dish and we will all share our good fortunes. The date is a Saturday, a few weeks from now. Maybe, he says, folding the paper and putting it in his pocket.
Oh, I hope so.
Lily waves her banner back and forth. Bits of glitter fly off and alight on the floor as she twirls.
Can I stick it up on my door?
Yes, good idea. Henry pulls open a drawer and rummages past scissors, pens and stamps to find a roll of tape. He hands it to her and points her upstairs. He refills the kettle and puts it on the stove. In the hallway, Rachel fusses with her keys, coat and purse.
So, what do you think?
She calls. Should we go?
Henry peers into his tin of oolong. Not much left. He tips a small handful of rolled up tea leaves into his mug.
Rachel comes into the kitchen.
It could be nice to get to know the other families. Some of them are like us.
Like us? Henry looks up. Chinese daddy and Caucasian mommy.
Oh.
The kettle starts to bubble on its burner. Henry, let's go. The sounds of Lily dispensing long, large strips of tape filter down into the kitchen. Henry glances at the ceiling.
Lily, that's enough tape. Don't waste it.
Rachel shouts,
I'm not wasting it.
The kettle shrieks. Henry turns off the gas and pours water directly onto his leaves, covering his mug with the lid from a peanut butter jar to hold in the heat.
Okay, we'll go. We'll see what it's all about.
When the Saturday arrives, Rachel is putting plastic wrap over a platter in the kitchen. It holds a mound of something studded with walnuts and ringed by Ritz crackers.
What is that?
It's a cheese ball.
A cheese ball?
It's an appetizer for the party. You spread the cheese on the crackers and ta-da! Delicious. We always used to have one on New Year's Eve growing up. Henry doesn't say anything. He shakes his head as he goes upstairs to get changed. He'd really rather stay home tonight. He hears Rachel telling Lily to put her shoes on.
It's just a party, he tells himself. Gong Xi Fa Cai! Happy New Year!
A broad-shouldered man in a press suit greets them at the door. His black hair is slightly silvered, and his proud and handsome face is creased. Henry detects traces of a northern accent. Beijing?
Edwin Huang, the man says, as he extends a hand to Henry. I don't believe we've met.
Huang's handshake is firm, insistent. His gaze seems to be searching for something in Henry. Not even over the threshold. Henry wonders if coming was a good idea.
Henry Dao, he says.
Edwin's eyes rest on Rachel.
Your wife?
He asks in Chinese.
Yes, this is my wife, Rachel.
Henry answers in English. He loosens his hand to put his arm around Rachel. Pleased to meet you, she says, and Edwin nods.
Lily has been enjoying the Chinese classes so much. Rachel starts.
Edwin turns to Lily and repeats his greeting.
Gong Xi Fa Cai.
Teacher Li, who has been lingering near the door, anxious that her pupils show off their learning, whispers to Lily,
Hong Bao.
Hong Bao Na Lai.
Lily stammers and Edwin beams. He produces a red envelope from his breast pocket and presents it to her. She graciously accepts with both hands, just as Teacher Li instructed. Rachel still holds her platter. A Chinese woman in a dark maroon qipao is heading towards them.
Oh, that's Patricia, one of the mothers from the classes, Rachel whispers.
Henry can hear the relief in Rachel's voice to see a familiar face. Patricia takes the platter.
Welcome. So nice to see you. Let's take this to the kitchen.
Rachel hands her coat to Henry and follows the other woman. As they walk away, Patricia looks down at the dish.
What is it?
She asks.
A cheese ball.
A cheese ball?
As Henry hangs up the coats, he surveys the room. Red and yellow streamers stretch along the walls, embellished every few feet by paper lanterns decorated with tassels and plastic ornaments of dogs. On the tables are red and yellow carnations and imitation mini firecrackers. How many people are here? Maybe 40? Although a few faces are vaguely familiar, he doesn't know anyone well. He had no idea there were so many Chinese in town. Henry is not sure where to stand or what to say. Some of the Chinese wives wear qipaos. Others wear stylish Western outfits. Everyone seems to have jade or gold jewellery. Rachel wears a plaid dress with a big white collar that shows off the jade pendant Mei-Lin gave her. The wives are fussing about the food, bringing out dishes. Rachel, usually so at ease, seems uncertain how to help. She chats with one of the Caucasian wives. Lily has been enticed over to a table where kids are decorating paper lanterns. Girls with shiny red ribbons in their pigtails and boys with short haircuts cluster around, jostling one another. Someone comes over to Henry and introduces himself as David Tian. He says he is neighbours with Tom Benson, Henry's colleague, and that he's glad to finally meet Henry in person. Tian's easy manner relaxes Henry, and over beers, they speak about when they came to the US, where they went to graduate school, how they came to be in Los Alamos. At some point, without realizing it, they have shifted into Chinese. Henry detects Tian's Sichuanese accent.
Are you from Chongqing?
Henry asks.
I was born there, after my family relocated during the War of Aggression. Hard times.
He shakes his head.
For a moment, neither speaks. Are your family still there? Some. Most of us went to Taiwan.
Henry nods. He figures that Tian is a little younger than he is, maybe the age of Pei Wen's youngest son. Tian slaps his knee when they discover they both went to National Taiwan University.
I knew it. A neither tied out alarm.